Well, at this point, it looks like we can have some questions and answers. I guess if you want to raise your hand and I can direct question to members of our board. Okay.
TB's going to be doing the rounds.
Okay, then I guess I don't have to.
You can direct TB.
Okay, go ahead.
They did go after the green glasses.
I mean, so.
they basically arrested David. They warned him that he could face the death penalty. They warned him that they could arrest his wife, that she could face the death penalty. And they then gave him a choice. We'll make you a deal. You cooperate, you say what you want you to say, and name others. And you'll get a prison sentence, David, and Ruth will be free to stay home and take care of the kids. And essentially, my parents were offered the same deal. The same thing could have happened to them, and they would have named others, and it would have gone on and on. It's because my parents refused that they became the center of the conspiracy. And ultimately, they were executed for resisting. I mean, that was their capital crime. And then over here, Tippy.
In 2002, David Greenglass, a disfigured, appeared on 60 Minutes, and he said just what you said, that he had been coerced into testifying the way he did. Mm-hmm. Also, several years ago, the Times reported that in the trial, in the case, not only was there no precedent for the death penalty, moreover, the prosecution was not even asking for it. So Kaufman took it upon himself completely in order to issue the death sentence. And I've always figured that Kaufman, this is just my opinion, I'm a writer, so my imagination, was an Uncle Tom. In order to impress his Gentile masters, he took it upon himself to say, I can kill Jews better than anybody else.
It's the kind of convoluted but complex way in which anti-Semitism played a significant role in the case. There was someone over here who was.
The question I have is, when the government came the week of the execution, the appearance, what did they actually offer? I know they were looking for information, but what were they really, do you have any knowledge of what they were going to steal in return?
I don't know, did everybody hear that question?
No.
When the government came to my parents in the last week of their lives, actually it was like slightly before that, I think it was June 8th, but you know, close enough, and made them an offer. What did they actually offer? What did they want my parents to do? You know, I knew that it's funny for me to come to New York and give a talk without my briefcase and without my bag of tricks. This time I just brought this, my talk, and I felt naked walking around New York without my briefcase, and now you ask a question, and if I had my briefcase, I'd pull out the CIA memo, which talks about what to do with what the Rosenbergs should do if what we want the Rosenbergs to do if they agree to cooperate, and it's truly hair-raising, what how they wanted them, to, what they, so there's a specific answer to that question, okay, that comes from the government's files. And I don't know whether you're one of these people who goes online, but, and I don't know whether the NCRC's new website has that particular memo, the CIMF memo up, but the Rosenberg Fund for Children memo does, website does. So if you were to go to www.rfc.org, very short address, and look for the drop-down box that says Rosenberg case, and say, and then go to what's called case documents, you'll find this memo and you can read it for yourself. That may be a hard chain to follow, but there is an answer. And I, unfortunately, I haven't memorized the memo. I mean, I would pull it out and read sections if I had it.
David Eisenhower just wrote a book about his grandfather.
Uh-huh.
And I was very surprised to see that he covered in a paragraph of the Rosenberg case and that Bernie Slovac case, trying to justify what the grandfather did based on certain evidence, but he wasn't too introspective for what the important point was. He was trying to recognize it and be apologetic. That's what I got at. And that's why he asked you that question, because I don't really know the answer. I've been reading about this and I've been a kid.
Well, I think that, you know, Eisenhower was unaware of the specifics of what the CIA was proposing. I once received a letter from a woman who acted as his personal secretary and talked about what a nice man he was and he, you know, blah, blah, but, you know, anyway.
This may not be important, but it's something that I'd like to hear a statement from you. When I read in the Times about Morton Sobel's statement, you know, I was horrified. But I had the feeling, listening to Morton Sobel in town hall some years ago, that he was sort of feeling, because of what happened in the Soviet Union, that maybe this was the best of all possible worlds. Was it a confession? What was his statement about?
Well, I can't see into Mort's mind. My belief is that he and my father were involved in this activity. They thought it was the right thing to do politically. And as Mort got older, he decided before he died he wanted to not go to his grave without saying what actually happened. Yeah.
You mean he thought it was wrong?
No.
No.
He just... No, he wasn't. No. If there's a... You confession to say I did X, okay, is a confession, but it's not necessarily a statement that X is wrong. It's an admission of guilt, but it's not a confession of.
Wrong
he could
doing.
Say, you know, I what I did. This is. I don't think he said that. He could say, this is what, these are the acts I committed and this is what I did. I'm just making a factual statement. He's not necessarily judging it right or wrong. Yeah, well.
I feel that a person, 93 years old, who, if he saw this society as he saw it at the time that he cooperated, he would not have found it timely to say that. Because the truth, you know, what is the truth in a society of wars? I really feel that the man just embraced the system as the best of all possible worlds. I think he did that.
Well,
and of course, I do commend him for being in Alcatraz and never, ever giving a name, because that's a true test of integrity. But he's ultimately, he doesn't really understand what he did. He can't give himself credit for what he did.
Now, that may be the case.
Might
you? Yeah.
Now, hello, like this.
I'll try. privilege of two inquiries, if I could. First of all, I cannot let go of the Rosenberg case. as I told you when we came, when I came in the door, I was in a third grade class with your older brother when he was shipped off with you to that home, and I there was another instance in my life when I virtually crossed paths with you. I believe that was at the Chaits summer place, and I do remember the protesting in the streets. I guess I was the age of your older brother, and I remember it vividly. And my family had no political activity, so I just can't let go of this case. And I'm a lawyer, and a constitutional law. I don't do it for a living, but I find it a great subject of interest. So I want to know. This is a case for the ages, and I wonder if you're going to be able to hang in there for a long period of time when my generation, which is the last generation that remembers this, and I don't remember it intellectually, I have an emotional and a vivid recollection of it, and I can't let go, but I don't want society to let go, but I think that if you don't instill the interest in a younger generation, regrettably, society might let go of this. How do you feel about that? And well, I have another question.
Well, the first is a rather complex reaction, and that is, you're right, we have to interest younger people in the case. I can tell you that every spring at my work, and you know, this is my day job, is running the Rosenberg Fund for Children, and my extracurricular activity isn't being involved on the board of the NCRC and various other things. But so I'm in my office usually, and every spring I get phone calls from high school students who are doing history projects on the case. And I always try to give them as much time as I can. And we do a lot of outreach, and whether through the internet and doing using social media, using the new means of communication, and that's why the NCRC has revived its website and tried to do that. But it's still a challenge. It's a big challenge. But the other thing is that oftentimes doing work of this sort requires money. You know, designing websites and putting out mailings and doing, having computers and networking and sending people to places to give speeches, all of those things are expensive. Someone asked me at the Judson Church last year or the year before, I think it was just last year, you know, how are my organization, the Rosenberg Fund for Children, going to survive because so many of our supporters are aging? And I said, well, one word. Bequests. You know, the NCRC is revived because of a bequest, in part. If people want the NCRC to be able to continue, that's one way they can make a real difference. And we'll do our best, those of us who continue, to interest young people. I'm in the process of turning over my position at the Rosenberg Fund for Children to my daughter,
wonderful,
who's 40
wonderful.
Years old.
Is she the lawyer?
Not quite. No, she's not. My other daughter's the lawyer.
Yeah, I read about that. Yeah.
But,
wonderful, wonderful.
But
yeah.
So, you know, we're trying to, but it's a challenge. And the second question, I'll try to be quick.
I'm not sure about the legalistics of this, but I understand that when someone dies, then their grand jury testimony can be released. Is that a correct statement?
That's actually, it's in general, grand jury statements are kept under wraps, okay? In my parents' case is an exception. The judge ruled that because the case was so of such great controversy and such importance, that the grand jury statements of all witnesses who had died or who were alive and didn't object could be released to the public, but that's unusual.
Yeah, so I don't mean this insensitively, but I don't know if you're in touch with your Uncle David, and is he still alive?
If he were not alive, I can promise you I wouldn't be in touch with him.
I get that.
Yeah. We can have a seance.
What I mean by that.
No, I understand your question. David, my understanding, one of the things that blows me away about my parents' case is how young everybody was. They were incredibly young. I mean, at the time in 1943, we're talking about David Greenglass was like 20. You know, Ruth was a teenager, his wife. So David, 2 years, when the grand jury statements were released, was 86 years old. So my understanding is that he's ill and alive. But when he dies, his grand jury statement will be released.
Will that be exciting, but will that be potentially great interest to us all?
I think it will be a very great interest because Ruth's statement doesn't mention anything about my mother being present at any meeting, doesn't mention anything about the typing, doesn't mention this sketch being transmitted, doesn't even mention the September 25th meeting, which is really the heart of the whole government case.
Seems important.
And if David's statement also has that missing, that will be a big step forward. I mean,
yes.
The thing that's changed, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years in my parents' case is that it used to be that it was like a jigsaw puzzle with a lot of missing pieces. We knew what my parents didn't do. We knew they didn't steal the secret of the atomic bomb. We knew what the Justice Department had done. We knew about the fabrication of evidence and all that stuff. But we didn't really know what happened. What's come out since then gives us a much clearer picture of what happened. So it's like additional pieces keep being added. And even though there's still missing pieces, anybody who puts a jigsaw puzzle together knows that if you get enough pieces, you begin to see what the whole picture looks like.
Thank you.
Get somebody over here. A couple of people over here.
Is there any more water?
Okay. Got hot up here all of a sudden.
Yeah, it really did. There is an aspect to this case, and really the whole history of this whole story that hasn't been mentioned. It's that the impact of this inspired events that went beyond this. Like, if you I don't know how big a fan all you are of the Warren Commission, but what Lee Harvey Oswald said in Moscow was that he got involved in Marxist activity because of the Rosenberg case, In Jonestown, Jim Jones's confession testimony or whatever said that it was also the Rosenberg case that sparked his interest in Marxism. It's an ongoing, I guess, tragedy you could say that the effects of this carried. So why do you attribute the, just how powerful this whole thing was?
Well, I have two answers to that. One. Just to give you another example, David Protes, who's the journalism professor at Northwestern University, who sent his graduate students out to interview all the people, the police and various others, and the convicts on death row and investigate their question in Illinois, that led to the ending of capital punishment in Illinois and the discovery that all these people were innocent and the whole thing that was like a major event. Well, he said he was inspired to do this because his father took him when he was 13 to my parents' funeral. There's been all sorts of inspirations. You just mentioned a couple. There are actually many more. In fact, people come up to me regularly and talk about the case and how it inspired them into a lifetime of activism. But I think the second answer is that it's not just about this case. That what you find is, when I first started with the reopening effort in the 1970s, and even as recently as when I started work in 1990, occasionally elderly people would come up to me and said that they were active in the struggle to save Sacco and Vanzetti, and that inspired them onto a lifetime of activism. And more recently, we have people who've been involved in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, young people, or Leonard Peltier's case. There's something about these kind of legal actions and the struggle to save people, particularly from the executioner, that moves people in a way that a lot of other things don't. But there's also another aspect of my parents' case, and that is that we're talking about a young couple with two young children who were part of a mass movement that took place in the 1930s through the 1950s. So what you had were hundreds of thousands of young Americans, families, children, all of whom felt a personal identification. People of my generation felt an identification with me and my brother. This could have been my parents. The parents thought this could have been me. And because everybody was so young, we are sitting here 60 years later, and there's a room full of people who are contemporaries, who are still here. So it went on and on. I mean, those things, all those cultural aspects are very powerful.
And,
you know, or like John F. Kennedy's assassination. I mean, you know, this.
This way, okay. I don't know how to say how much I admire you. There aren't any words for it, really. But what I want to ask is, I hope that you will write another book. and here's what the question I want you to write about in that book and to answer now, and that is, I felt the same way you did when Sobel talked to the newspaper. And I just thought, what kind of fool, how could he do this? What end could it possibly serve, you know, for him to say this, you know? I had read in Invitation to an Inquest. I was convinced.
Use the mic.
I was convinced that the Rosenbergs were innocent. They had been sent to death because of anti-Semitism and anti-communism. And so I thought, what good could this possibly serve for him to be saying this? Well, as it turns out, it does serve several fine purposes. One is to help us fight political repression now, as you know. But the other is, and I think this is the deeper and more important point to me anyway, and I'm an American history teacher, is to help us see that during the decade from 1940 to 1950, wouldn't any justice-loving person, might they not desire to aid the Soviet Union? What? Of course they might, you know? I mean, I think I would have if I had been old enough then to. What I want, so the question is, where did you ever find the courage to keep searching for the truth? You must have been so up against so many people like me and you know, who would have said, well, you know, they were innocent. Listen, please, what are you talking about? How could you keep searching for them? Where did you find the courage to?
Well, you know, it's the reality is that a lot of times the truth just, you know, jumped up and punched us in the nose. It wasn't that we were necessarily looking for it. It was kind of hard to avoid it. Now, it is true that we opened the door. I mean, and I'm very pleased about this. The very first thing we did when we went public in 1973 was to file a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. And some of the press came to us and said, well, what if you find out stuff that you don't want to hear? And we said, well, you know, we don't think we're going to find that. But if we do, the truth is more important than any position that we take. And I really do believe that. And so it's been a long road with many twists and turns. And, you know, it is a very humbling experience to get to 2010 and have Walter Schneer publish a book that shows that a lot of your theory of the case was wrong. That, you know, the Greenglasses weren't just weak government dupes. The Greenglasses, it wasn't that the Greenglasses invented a crime that didn't exist because to save their skins. They took a crime that they actually did and put it on someone else. And I'm not even sure that the government realized that they were lying. And then, you know, you think about it, you have like a New York Times reporter like Sam Roberts, who's very well known, and he has his TV show, and he's way up in the New York Times hierarchy, and he pays David Greenglass all this money to tell him his story and publishes this book, The Brother, and Greenglass feeds him a pack of lies, and this supposedly brilliant investigative reporter can't even figure it out, and publishes this story. And, you know, it is a humbling experience to go through this for decade after decade and discover that, you know, yeah, you got some things right, but you were wrong. You know, that's the process of learning things. And I think it's really important. It is really hard, but it's also really important, because what we really have to avoid is what I call political fundamentalism, whether it be left, right, or center. This idea that we have all the answers and that we know what the truth is, and that what that does is it puts blinders on us. So when new facts come in and we try to integrate them, rather than trying to figure out what really happened, we just throw them aside and say, no, it can't be, and go blindly ahead. And that, over and over and over again politically, that leads you to a dead end. And the longer you go on that path, the more irrelevant you become. So it is difficult. It's difficult, though. And there are a lot of times, you know, I wish it would go away, you know. Here it comes again. But
that the understanding of why somebody would want to help the Soviet Union at that time.
I hope that I did that in my talk.
This country supported Nazism
until
Germany declared war on America.
I know. Then we
they blockaded loyalist Spain and sold oil to Germany.
One person
the point is that they were supporting Nazism. Before the war was over and the Soviet Union made these tremendous strides, and the film, Judgment at Nuremberg, it's a Hollywood film, but it speaks the truth. I mean, it's unbelievable. I saw it many times. It shows that while the Nazis are being prosecuted at Nuremberg, they change their minds. They want the Nazis on their side, the Americans,
right,
and they want to kill the Soviet Union.
Right.
And that's when the Cold War started. Right. And people like the Rosenbergs saw that it was a very serious thing. The Soviet Union was, they would have destroyed the Soviet Union. And there was, the Soviet Union, imperfect, yes. However, it was a real act of control of the world with that atom bomb. And people like the Rosenberg saw the necessity to do something about it. And their courage. When I found out that they were in fact involved, I admired them more.
Yeah.
I found that courage is beyond my belief. I could never do that courage.
Right. Stalin right. instructed the Comintern representative to Germany in the 30s to ally with the Nazis to bring down the Weimar Republic. The exact quote was something like, okay. First, we got to get rid of these.
Let's get back to a question and answer period.
Please.
TB.
I understand. But I do want to just respond one thing to.
I do want to say, I thought that's what I said in my speech.
Okay, we're going to have time for one more question.
No, I. If you look at what I said, that's exactly what I said.
We have to ask you to discuss this afterwards because we have to leave very soon. We have time for one more question in the back.
Hello. Thank you. I have two things. Like the Rosenbergs, I went to Seward Park High School, and the dean of that school once went into the records, and he found that in the days when citizenship grades were given, your parents received A's in citizenship. So you might want to look those records up.
Yeah, they were very good high school students.
But you mentioned the formative period of poverty, the depression which the young people grew up in. Many radicals turned to the Socialist Party, which was not attached to a foreign government. I'm sure these people were rigorous in their analytic thinking, and they were committed in their activism. But because that party wasn't connected to a foreign government, they never got entangled. It seems a shame that your parents weren't members of the Socialist Party.
Well, you know, as I think I said in my talk, it's one of the points of disagreement that I do have with my parents, that I think that it's one thing to get involved in struggles that you can see in front of you. It's another thing to get involved with foreign governments, because you really don't know what's going on there. You know, when I think about the disagreement I have with my parents, it's they looked out their window and they saw the Communist Party was doing good in their neighborhood. And it was. And as I said, the Communist Party was the good guys and the capitalist press was the bad guys. And they extrapolated from that that everything that the capitalist press was saying about the Soviet Union was a pack of lies. Therefore, the Stalin purge trials, all that stuff, that was a pack of capitalist lies. It wasn't going on. They just rejected that possibility. And I know that when I was a young person, when I was involved in politics during the 1960s, I had all these beliefs about other countries that were perfect. You know, everything that the North Vietnamese did was right, and everything the United States government did was wrong. That was, you know, and it turned out that it wasn't that simple. So I became very cautious about hitching my wagon to some foreign government, because it's one thing to engage in struggles that you can see in front of you. It's another to get involved with foreign governments, because the reality is you really don't know what they're doing. It's very difficult to discern what they're doing. And that doesn't mean they didn't do a lot of good things. And it doesn't mean the Soviets didn't take the brunt of the fight in World War II. And it doesn't mean that it was that helping the Soviets defeat the Nazis in World War II, frankly, I think that's a pretty good deal. And I think that was
American radicals didn't choose the Communist
Party. Right, that's right. Some did and some didn't. Yeah, well, that's true. But, you know, I just don't know. You know, like my parents in the neighborhood where they were growing up, this is the role that made sense, and I think it made sense in terms of their lives and who they were. And that, you know.
That's all she wrote. We have one more announcement.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Robbie. I'm Monty Itzkowitz, and actually I'm treasurer of the NCRRC. And I just want to thank you all for coming. Two things I have in mind, three actually. One is to make sure that everybody has signed the sign-in sheet, because we're trying to build up a mailing list to be able to let you know about upcoming events that we'll be planning. Number two, we have books for sale at a very steep discount on the counter there. You can take a look at them. The books are $10 each. And the third is an appeal for funds. You all know that it's not inexpensive to run an organization, to have meetings such as this and others that we're planning. And you should all have received a little contribution form on your seats. You could either make out a check or cash donation.